Well, welcome to all of you tonight. My name is John Beck, and I'm the stand-in moderator tonight because Dean Jackson Elmore has lost her voice. We have an APB out for it, so if any of you find a voice anywhere in the building, but we're very happy that she's here with us. The Dean of the Honors College is the patron of this entire series, Sharper Focus, Wider Lens. And tonight, we're talking about zombies, apocalypses, monsters, real and imagined. And we have a panel of four wonderful faculty presenters up here. But let me tell you a little bit about the evening first and make sure that we're all on the same page. First of all, I'm going to introduce the four wonderful colleagues up here at the table in order that they're going to be speaking. They're going to go in order without stopping for questions. At the end of the time when the four of them have done their presentations, we're going to open it up on the panel just for a quick bit of crosstalk in terms of whether or not something that Malcolm said really forced Megan to think about something. And you know, so we're going to be jumping around just a little bit up here just to try to build some common understanding up here among the panel. Then we're going to open it up to you. And the fabulous Stephanie Cepak in the back, who is the one who handles all of our press, our Facebook page, and other things, is going to be wandering around with a microphone. And so just raise your hand when the time comes, and we're going to be happy to hear from you, either comments or questions for the panel based on what you hear tonight. Now, I would ask that in the era of science fiction, let us put these on stun and not destroy, so that if you've got them on vibrate, that's good. So, because we are filming tonight, and all of these Sharper Focus, Wider Lens presentations are put on the Honors College website. So if it's always interesting to find out what ringtones people have, but it is, it's great since we're filming if we can make sure that we don't hear those cell phones tonight. Let me do a commercial. You'll see scattered about the various chairs. The next and last one of the semester, we do four of these a year, is coming up on Monday, March 30th. It's called The Next Revolutions. And all of these are really meant to showcase the wonderful job that MSU faculty are doing, either in relation to their teaching, research, their general thinking, whatever they happen to be working on that's under these broad topics. So that's kind of the rundown on how we're working tonight, and I think that's everything. So let me introduce the panel and get this whole thing going. On my far right is Valita Wensloff, and she's the Outreach Coordinator for the Department of Media and Information and the Media Sandbox in the College of Communication Arts and Sciences. Valita provides website, graphical, and branding support for departmental events, the Meaningful Play Conference, specializations such as the Serious Games and Information Technology programs, Michigan Creative Film Alliance, and Media Sandbox related projects. In addition, she is the internship coordinator and facilitates 4 credit internships. She received her master's degree from the Department of Media and Information, formerly Telecommunication Information Sciences and Media, at MSU with an emphasis on digital media, art, and technology, and received her bachelor's degree from Ferris State in television production. Valita currently teaches Communication Arts and Sciences 204, which is web design, and previously taught CIAS 207, Media Animation, as well as undergraduate and graduate level independent studies. On my immediate right is Malcolm McGee. Malcolm is an associate professor in the Department of History in the College of Social Science and the Department of Religious Studies within the College of Arts and Letters. His fields include American religious history, progressive era politics, and 19th century political and religious thought. His book, What the World Should Be, Woodrow Wilson and the Crafting of a Faith-Based Foreign Policy, was released by Baylor University Press in 2008. In 2009 and 10, he worked with several colleagues from the Department of History on a Teaching American History project in Battle Creek. Currently, Malcolm is working on a chapter in the Blackwell Companion Series on Woodrow Wilson and a multi-author work on religion and the Great War. He is the director of the Institute for the Study of Christianity and Culture. Malcolm received his PhD in the history of international relations in 2004. Following a career in religious and nonprofit organizations, he has taught several history and religious study courses as well as several IIH and ISS courses. On my immediate left, Megan Donahue is a professor in the Department of Physics and Astronomy in the College of Natural Science. She studies clusters of galaxies. She pays particular attention to how clusters are found behind, because any bias in finding clusters can lead to a bias in our conclusions about them. She also studies the metallicity distribution and physics of intergalactic gas. Her work includes models and observational tests of cooling flows in the gas within clusters. She did postdoctoral research in observational astronomy at the observatories of the Carnegie Institution of Washington in Pasadena, California, and at the Space Telescope Science Institute in Baltimore, Maryland. She was an astronomer for the Institute, working on the data archive in the James Webb Space Telescope prior to joining the faculty at MSU. She received her bachelor's degree from MIT and a PhD in astrophysics from the University of Colorado. And last but not least, on my left, Glenn Stutzke is a senior clinical instructor in the School of Social Work within the College of Social Science. His academic interests include bullying and cyberbullying in Indian boarding schools. As a social worker, Glenn has been long interested in how humans behave and why. He has worked extensively with educators, law enforcement, and community members on these issues for nearly 20 years. He is the lead faculty member for Social Work 290, Surviving the Coming Zombie Apocalypse, Disasters, Catastrophes, and Human Behavior, which received the AT&T MSU Best Fully Online Course Award of Excellence. He earned his bachelor's degree from MSU and a master's degree from the University of Michigan. Let me say that this topic tonight, you know, all of us are very interested, I'm sure, in things that go bump in the night. Horror films and horror novels are still the stuff of everyone's bedside reading table. And at the same time, there are real things, too, that worry us. And tonight we're going to hear about both real things, fictional things, weaving the two together, how things often influence our political thought and figure a very strong way into how we conceive of ourselves in relation to the universe, religion, and so forth. So we're going to hear from this wonderful panel, then we're going to open it up across the panel just for some quick crosstalk, and then we're going to have all of you have your opportunity to weigh in on tonight's topic, again, zombies, apocalypses, and monsters, real and imagined. So, starting on my right, the leader will kick it off.
Well, good. I think this is working. Can you all hear me? First time, nope. How about now? Anyone? No?
All right. I think that's on now.
Okay. Well, I'll just talk a little bit louder. Hello there. My name is Valita Wensloff, as you can see there. So you're probably wondering, why am I here? Why am I going to talk about monsters? The reason is that I love monsters. I've always loved them since I was a little girl. I wasn't interested in the standard little girl things. That's Gamera, by the way, which I loved watching. Sometimes I was sick at home, and I would watch those old movies. I also loved monsters which battled other monsters and things of that nature. However, we're here to discuss monsters, not my interest in monsters. So one of the things that's really important to keep in mind is that the concept of monsters is across many cultures, and a lot of them actually share a lot of things which we're going to get into. They populate many video games, a lot of popular culture, and this is the important part, is that monsters, on the whole, draw from mythologies and literary interpretation of those mythologies. So you have fantasy works which expand on ideas of monsters, dragons, and things of that nature. And you have a lot of the recurring things between these cultures, like squiggly things which live in the ocean or scaly things which live out in the desert, monsters like that. So the reason I'm discussing this is because I made some monsters along with my co-worker Andrew Dennis for the Meaningful Play Conference. So the whole concept of the conference is that it is about designing and studying games that matter. It occurs every other year, so we had one just this past year in October of 2014. Here's the thing, is that we discuss some pretty difficult topics in Meaningful Play. It's typically researchers who are talking about things like gender, violence. Are games prevalent in violent acts? Do they bring about violence? That sort of thing. So we also discuss educational games, how you can use games for learning, that sort of thing. So with that in mind, I wanted to develop something that could be a fun theme for it. And I had to keep in mind that not every attendee of this was actually a gamer. A lot of them were academics who were interested in studying games and society and games, but they didn't necessarily play the games themselves. They all studied, though, games, were interested in games and things surrounding games. So we had actually a really nice mix of academics and professionals who were in the game design industry, and that's a pretty wide range of folks. The previous theme that we used was actually ninjas, wizards, and monsters, all kind of around the world. I like to say that the monster there is biting the world, but that's just me. Maybe it's hugging it, I'm not sure. That's up to your interpretation. So one of the things that I needed to keep in mind was these monsters needed to be geared to this specific audience, people who know about games. Wanted these monsters to have a variety of visuals because people are interesting and different. So we wanted to have different monsters. We wanted the monsters to be friendly. Because these topics tend to be very difficult, we wanted the actual theme of the conference, the visual theme, to be open and loving and gentle. We wanted things to be familiar, kind of familiar monsters, but still new. I mean, well, I love dragons, but I didn't necessarily want to make a whole bunch of dragons for this. So we also wanted it to be kind of inviting and gentle, considering these topics. I used this as inspiration, which in retrospect was perhaps not the most inviting and gentle, but it's basically this image, for those of you on the podcast, of a really terrifying looking monster receiving a flower from a little girl. But that kind of basically sums up the attitude that I had going forward. So I asked my friend Andrew Dennis, who also works in our department, for some assistance. He is a game designer and developer. He does 3D graphics and things, and he's an illustrator. And this is very important because I draw like a three-year-old with a crayon, so I needed his help. So originally, we wanted to have about a dozen different monsters, but unfortunately, for the t-shirts, I should say, we had three t-shirts that we used, plus a volunteer t-shirt, but we ended up with three because, unfortunately, it was just too pricey for that. However, all of the other monsters that we made ended up being showcased in the program, which was very fun. We also decided to use just the heads of the monsters, and there were several reasons for this. The main one being that it's easier to reduce the colors for shirts and things, but also you can bring a lot of personality in just the face of a creature, just like a person has a lot of personality. So you're probably wondering, okay, well, how do you start making a monster? What if I want to make my own? That's a very good question. What I would recommend, and this is what I learned from working with Andrew, is that you start with three basic shapes, a square, a circle, and a triangle. So that's what we did. These, although we made quite a few more, were the beginning monsters that we used that ended up on the t-shirts and the swag bag, which all the way down there, he has one of the swag bags. Maybe he'll hold it up later. But we actually made quite a few more, which you can see here, and some of these we expanded upon, but we didn't necessarily use because they were too similar to other things. So more specifically, if we want to design a monster, how do we design something that is friendly and or creepy and or kind of unexpected? Because like I say, you don't necessarily want to use things which are expected. Okay, I don't necessarily want to use a unicorn. I don't know if that's technically a monster, but we'll pretend for the moment that it is. So the first thing that you want to do is make sure that you have some human-like quirks in things. So maybe like a gap tooth or a lopsided smile or things of that nature. That's pretty helpful. Also, eyebrows, very helpful. There's the eyebrow. There's off. There's on. As you can see, with an eyebrow, it looks a lot more friendly and not quite as weird. So there's another one with the eyebrows. The other thing we want to do, too, is that we want to have something unexpected. We want to introduce characteristics in the monster which are not typically seen. For instance, we have orcs, which have shown quite a bit in fantasy settings. We wanted to make the business orc. So we want to also have a variety of creatures, which I touched on before. One of the things that is very important is to have a face so that you can actually design the monster. You can make pretty creepy monsters without faces, but you can't make very friendly ones. You also want to avoid having too many teeth when you're making a smiling monster. So I recommend something along this line, which you have just a couple little fangs, which are kind of cute. The other thing, too, is to make something which is a little asymmetrical. So maybe if it has horns, one of them is broken or down or something of that nature. We used Squiddix, which is Squid Skrillex. We had a little too much fun with this. Sometimes we kind of went a little bit too creepy, maybe too many eyes, I don't know. I was really pro many-eyed puppy. Andrew was not, that's okay. But one of the main things, too, is that monsters are pretty enigmatic, just as video games are. We don't always necessarily understand how they were created or why. So we had an interpretive cover. The front, we see the top, the teeth at the top, and the teeth at the bottom. The back of this program, then, usually had sponsors. In this case, though, we wanted to have a little story. Is this monster eating the creatures which were here in the front? Or are they looking inside? Maybe it has a cavity or something. It's hard to say. We don't know. But basically, that is how we created these monsters for meaningful play.
Malcolm?
Well, the end of the world. Cause for speculation among theologians and a glimmer of hope for the unfortunate person caught on an endless, awkward blind date. The United States, because of its particular religious democratic history, has been a hotbed for speculation about the end of the world and a source for many of the popular concepts and words that are used generally when people talk about the apocalypse. And in this country, at least, it's the language of Christianity, particularly evangelical Christianity, that often gets used. And these Christian terms dominate American discourse and have crept into American popular culture in song lyrics and movies, everything from the Rapture, Armageddon, Rosemary's Baby, The Omen, many other thrillers, Black Sabbath albums, and of course now a movie with Nicolas Cage that simply is impossible to review. Briefly, I'd like to do a short history of a few of the various kinds of imagined religious apocalypses, and basically create and do about a semester's worth of work in 8 minutes, which my students would prefer if I did it that way, I suspect. The apocalypse, the word, literally means to uncover or reveal. So someday, for instance, if you're in a restaurant and they bring you one of those fancy plates with a little silver cover and they take it off, say, "Oh my God, an apocalypse!" And just watch what your fellow travelers at the table do. The term is used for a typical kind of ancient writing. There were lots of apocalyptic kinds of writings sort of before, during, and after the Common Era. And typically it stays there, although there are modern genres of apocalyptic writing, A Christmas Carol being an example of that, where Ebenezer Scrooge has an apocalypse where he is slowly, steadily brought to an understanding or an uncovering of something about himself that he didn't particularly want to know. But the word apocalypse here comes from the New Testament book of Revelation. The word revelation is apocalypse. It's known by various titles, either the Revelation or the Revelation of Jesus Christ or the Revelation of St. John the Divine. But the word revelation means apocalypse. So the book of Revelation is, in a sense, designed to remove the lid, to reveal something that's hidden, although it usually has not been much help at doing that historically. The term apocalypse, however, because of that, has come to common usage to mean a lot of dramatic world-ending events, thus a series of historically terrible snowstorms a few years ago became snowpocalypse, and, you know, we may have had a minor snowpocalypse this morning. Anyway, so that's the history of the word itself. Now for a quick run through history. There have been some tracks that historically the end of the world has run on, at least in Western Christian thought, and therefore it's crept into a lot of other thought as well. The first is amillennialism, which literally means no millennium. So that's a little bit misleading, because what it means is simply millennium means 1,000 years. It's talking about a specific thing out of this book, this apocalyptic book. And most people who are amillennialists believe it's figurative, therefore they don't worry too much about the end of the world, and it has that very little effect on them. The second form was very popular in the United States in the 18th and 19th centuries. It was very popular, and it's called postmillennialism. And this is the idea that somehow or other you were called to make the world a better place, to bring heaven to earth, in other words, to usher in the millennium. And what happened was, this was popular from the time of the Great Awakening until the First World War. And it fueled a lot of American progressives, progressive political ideas, etc., because these people believed that they were helping to bring the millennium on earth. And this concept was so popular that it became part of the secular progressive landscape as well. And it shows up, for instance, in Edward Bellamy's book, Looking Backward. These progressives working on a post-millennial intellectual foundation worked to end child labor, get the right of women to vote, and generally make the world better. Then, of course, historically there was premillennialism, and if you were a premillennialist, you tended to believe that there was an actual 1,000 years, it was a literal thing, and by and large the world had to get bad because it was bad and it needed some kind of divine intervention. So why waste time trying to reform anything? This phrase was sort of live and let die. However, sometime in the 1830s, a little girl named Margaret MacDonald had a vision of something called a secret rapture of the church at a Bible conference near Glasgow, Scotland. A man named John Nilsson Darby, the founder of a Protestant group called the Plymouth Brethren, added this idea to his own unique system of what he called dispensations. That he used to divide and systemize both human time and the Bible. A former Confederate soldier and embezzler named Cyrus Schofield read these ideas while in jail and later popularized them in a Schofield Study Bible. And while there are no ancient names connected with dispensationalists, there are a lot of well-known modern proponents of this idea. Hal Lindsey's late 60s book, The Late Great Planet Earth, and of course the Left Behind series that has made Tim LaHaye a millionaire. And also given Nicolas Cage another movie. So what does this matter, you may ask? Well, here's my hypothesis, and I think it's more than coincidence that at a time when most people believed they could bring heaven to earth, they engaged in progressive activity. They cared about the condition of workers, slavery, women's rights, and lots of other progressive notions. Following the First World War, when fundamentalism got its strongest boost, that same non-coincidence, in my opinion, reversed this idea and promoted the idea that there was really nothing you could do to make the world better. Indeed, it should get worse so it can slip into its Armageddon. This, I believe, caused many of the same zealous religious people who in the past had been foot soldiers and captains in the progressive movement to retreat to their insular ways until sometime in the 80s, when the American evangelicalism left its traditionally left-leaning and progressive side and became the foot soldiers for the political right. Whereas before, family values were coupled with social justice, care for the poor, and human rights, now they were coupled with supply-side economics and corporate welfare. Finally, there is, however, I believe, a new movement afoot, particularly among younger evangelicals, that may indicate a return to a more historic and optimistic view of the end, a movement that includes care for the earth, justice for the poor, the creation of some kind of heaven on earth. This growing group is more engaged, more concerned about what kind of society we live in, not willing to let things simply get worse and hope for destruction. And this might best be summed up in a recent song written by some younger evangelicals in which the chorus says, "Praise the Lord, my husband's been raptured. Praise the Lord, that SOB is gone." Perhaps these younger millennials, both religious and secular, will reconstitute for us a new progressive era.
Well, thank you, Malcolm. Now we'll switch sides, and to my left.
All right, I'm not seeing this. Go on. All right. Okay, so they dragged a scientist into here to tell you about real apocalypses. So I have real bad news for everybody. You're all gonna die. But so what, right? Do you really want to live forever? So we're gonna go through, if you live forever, I'm gonna tell you about the future of the Earth in a nutshell, so in 8 minutes. So do you really want to live forever? Well, do ya?
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life. Electric word, life, it means forever, and that's a mighty long time. But I'm here to tell you.
If you live forever, or even if you think about the future beyond your inevitable demise, you have some problem solving ahead of you. So there's some near-term challenges, and I think a lot of people are aware of them. For one, there's climate change. This is a picture of a glacier in Alaska. And on the left, you have the glacier in 1941, and on the right, you're seeing that glacier in 2004. If you were a student in Alaska, you wouldn't be asking whether climate change was going to happen. You would be watching it happen in front of you right now, seeing villages slip into the ocean. There's other possibilities. There's things like genetic vulnerabilities from the genetic structure of plants being uniform, superbugs, immune to all forms of antibiotics, nasty things. This is from that show, The Helix. They all turned into zombies. But the thing that, you know, a scientist worries about, I think, the thing that is on our minds is climate change. 2014 was the hottest year on record. We see that the carbon dioxide content of the atmosphere, carbon dioxide acts as a greenhouse gas. It prevents the Earth from radiating infrared radiation into space, and therefore, like a blanket that covers you and allows you to heat up, carbon dioxide is causing the planet to heat up. So we see on the far right-hand plot is the atmospheric carbon dioxide is measured at Mauna Loa Mountain in Hawaii. You see the cyclic variation and an incredible trend upwards. We know, scientists know, that the carbon dioxide that is being released into the atmosphere driving this temperature upwards is being released by us. For example, if you look at this black curve over here, that is the rise in global temperatures. The blue curve, the one that doesn't follow the black curves, that's the model that follows the greenhouse gases that are not released by us. If we include the greenhouse gases released by human beings, we can represent this change quite accurately. There's other reasons for why we think the CO2 is coming from us. For example, the isotopic ratios in the carbon are based on those of fossil fuels, not plants that lived and rotting today. So we're causing it, and we're the ones who have to do something about it. There's an instability in this process, though, and that is that the people who are going to be impacted the most are contributing the least amount of greenhouse gases. The people who are contributing the most greenhouse gases are the wealthiest, and they will be able to insulate themselves against this the impact of climate change. So there's an instability in the imbalance in effect and possible impact. So the cost of mitigation is a real cost, but the cost of no action is huge. So if we survive that, that would be cool. There's this other thing. There's an asteroid somewhere out there. It's gonna hit. It's inevitable. They hit about once every 100 million years or so. There's a lot of little things that hit us all the time. When the big one hits, you're not going to be hanging out on the beach. Anybody who really follows this plot line is going to be running. If you ever see the ocean do this, go away. Get to higher ground now. Daddy. It's from Deep Impact, 1998. So in that movie, the two towers are still standing. You always have to destroy New York in that movie. Because it is the center. Here's how it goes. And you don't care about those people because they weren't the stars. The stars live. All right. So those are real. And there's not a whole lot you can do about them unless you catch them very, very early. There have been real impacts that have happened 65 million years ago. You all know about the dinosaurs. About 200 million years ago, there was a gigantic volcanic eruption that caused a lot of ash to be dumped into the upper atmosphere, causing a winter that lasted long enough to kill off many of the life forms, and the dinosaurs survived. So these are inevitable catastrophes. The lifespan of species are measured in maybe 100 million years or so. But there's another catastrophe that's even harder to avoid, and that is that the sun is going to evolve in about 5 billion years. A group of kindergartners, when I told them about this inevitable catastrophe, said, "Is that 5 million years or 5 billion years?" And I said, "It's 5 billion years." And they went, "Phew." Okay. So when the sun turns into a red giant, it gets really big, and it gets a little too close to the Earth. Everything that we know, the oceans boil off, the atmosphere boils off, and possibly the rock itself melts. So eventually you're going to have to move, and you probably can't take all your stuff. The universe itself is facing its own sort of catastrophe. That is, no stars live forever. The most massive ones explode as supernova. Stars like the sun itself will eventually lose all its gas and become white dwarfs. And stars themselves eventually stop forming as galaxies get farther and farther apart. You probably have heard of the expansion of the universe, and they use up their gas supply. Everything else cools. White dwarfs, planets, brown dwarfs, failed stars, cools and just gets colder. Matter itself doesn't live forever either. Protons decay. 10 to the 34 years we have. It's a long time. Neutrons, you might be thinking, what about the neutrons? Well, they only survive about 10 minutes outside of a nucleus. It's the protons we're going to be waiting on. And even the black holes evaporate. Stephen Hawking tells us the most supermassive black holes out there, weighing in about 10 billion times the mass of the sun, have about 10 to the 100 years to go. Thanks, Stephen Hawking. De nada. Finally, that expansion of the universe, it's accelerating. The expansion is speeding up, and if the acceleration also speeds up, there is a phenomenon known as the Big Rip, which will disintegrate space and time. So that's a big solution, a big problem to deal with if you live forever. So I was asked to classify these things, stuff we can do something about versus stuff we can't, near term, next 10 years within our lifetime, and longer term. But ultimately, all we have to decide to do with the time that is given with us. And that's from Gandalf. I wanted to wrap up with that. Thanks.
Great, thanks.
Okay, now I'm freaked out. was great. Can we dim the lights?
Yeah. But, this is supposed to work, and let's try it now.
You sound good.
Now that would be one.
No, this is it.
Yeah, I'm on three.
Are we ready? Can we dim the lights? We don't know. All right. I'm going to start off with a little video here.
Until you're actually in a catastrophe, you don't know how you'd behave. You'd like to think you'd be the person who wouldn't leave anybody behind. Put others before yourself. But would you? Is that an understanding? You know, in times of catastrophe, some people find their humanity, but others, they lose theirs.
Okay, that's a little trailer we did to advertise this class, Surviving the Coming Zombie Apocalypse, Disasters, Catastrophes, and Human Behavior. And you see me there. I'm at a place where I've made it down a little path. This class has multiple endings. It's kind of a lifetime type event because how do you actually behave when you're in a disaster, a catastrophe, or an apocalypse? That's what it really comes down to. And I like what Megan had to say at the end. What do you do with your time? If a catastrophe was to happen tonight, you know where we would be? Well, we're here. You know who would be your survival group? It would be all of us folks here. And this is where we are. This class employs small survival groups. You get put into a survival group. You get put into scenarios, and you have to decide, what would I do? As Malcolm said, the word apocalypse means revealed. So this class, in addition to academic content, it potentially can also reveal about what would I do in certain situations. And it's not as easy as you think it might be, because in a disaster, catastrophe, apocalypse, you get put into unusual situations. You get put in situations that test not just your intelligence, but that test your morality and what's really on the inside. I wanted to say I've got two survivor forms. Can I get a couple volunteers? Anyone would like to fill this form out? This is something we have in the course. I thought somebody might like to take a look at it and fill it out. There's a little thing you get, too, with it. Yeah, okay, here's one. Anybody else? In this class, you don't know whether you're going to survive or whether you're not. In a disaster or catastrophe, you never get all the information, and there's chaos and incomplete information. Learning how to understand information and to weigh it can make the difference between life and death. One of the things we incorporate into this class, some of the traditional academic things in terms of the latest information and research there is out there on how humans behave. We behave differently, and until it's revealed, I don't think we really know. There's a small percentage of people in any given catastrophe, maybe about 8% or so, that they scream and yell and, you know, flail their arms around and things like that. They're not bad people. It's just the way that they're wired. There's other people that get exceedingly calm and they can see everything. And then there's people that physically actually freeze up. They can't move. And we have research on this from many different disasters. You have to literally grab them and say, come on, we're going. They're not bad people. They're not any different than you and me. They're just wired that way. And then the big group of us, we're like, something's going on. Something really bad, I think, has happened. I'm not sure. Anybody got a plan? You know, maybe I should call somebody in that. And we're looking for that. I want to tell you that this particular course is kind of organic. When it begins, sometimes we don't even know exactly where it's going to go. It's a course, actually, without a syllabus. I hate syllabus, syllabi. I think there's a certain element of evil with them. I mean, they have their place. But you don't know in a catastrophe what's going to happen next, so the class doesn't run from 10:40 to 11:15. You might find out something at 10 o'clock at night, 3 o'clock in the morning. That's just how it happens. And then how do you respond, and how do you make a choice that may result not just only in someone else's life or death, you know, but yours. And I want to tell you, we're very fortunate tonight because I have the two of the three other team members with me. Down at the table there, Kisa Mohammed, instructional designer extraordinaire. We brought some artifacts from the course, from behind the scenes of the stuff that we create. And another one of the instructional designers and creators here, Chris Irvin. Chris, can you raise your hand? There he is, Christopher Irvin. Two amazing people. The one person who's not here tonight is our beloved Zombrarian, Haley Mooney. We have a librarian embedded in this course who helps bring the academic content and the assignments and anchors it with the great resources of the librarian, with the great resources of the library. And I'll tell you, librarians to me are like heroes. They are a little quirky, and they actually have conferences, although I have no idea what they do at these librarian conferences. But every year, Haley has like a budget to go to Munich or somewhere like that for gathering of all the librarians and stuff. And I'd love to kind of like see what's going on with that. But a librarian is someone that is a hero, and they also play a real role in the preservation and accessing knowledge and information. And I would want them to be in my group there if I had an opportunity. So we try to make this class as real as possible. You are immersed into an online simulated event, which happens to be a coronal mass ejection has hit the Earth, an X class. I may not have that exactly right. Megan could tell you exactly. It has a major impact on the Earth, and it also turns some people into zombies, which is a problem, okay? And you have to deal with. But I'll tell you the real thing, what I'd like to close up with, is it has to do with relationships. And I'm often asked by people in the media or other people, well, what weapon should I bring into the zombie apocalypse? Should I bring a katana or a shotgun, or what should I have, and how can we keep purifying water? The single greatest asset you can bring into any catastrophe, disaster, or apocalypse are your relationships. That's the best asset that you can bring. And if you're a Walking Dead fan, you saw the trailer for the second half of the season that's coming up here. What did Rick Grimes say? He says, well, it's all about survival, and it's about surviving together. Whatever we're facing, it has to do with surviving together. And now I just want to give out, I've got a little mini poster for the two people who have volunteered. I wanted to give you this here. And maybe we could even get Chris to autograph those if you want them over at the table right afterwards. So thank you
Great.
Very much.
Well, thank you, Glenn. So now I'm going to open it up to my colleagues up here to comment on what they heard. We already heard that Gandalf is cool from Glenn. And other comments about any of the four and how you see them tying together. I've got a couple of framing questions that I want to throw out, and then we'll open it up. Comments from any of you?
Yeah, am I on? You said there are cross-cultural common monsters? Are there some that are more common than others? Can you, you know, you, in these cross, is there some kind of monster that is more often everywhere than another kind?
I would say certainly sea monsters, because of course, especially when cultures were first starting to go out beyond the borders and into the sea, there would be storms, and storms would happen and make their ships sink. So of course, monsters. It was monsters that caused it, right? Not bad planning or ignoring the weather. So I would say the sea monsters tend to be pretty, and they're always like just like the things you would find in the sea, squiggly and kind of gross and mushy. And then dragons. So as we know, there's eastern and western dragons. I say as we know, now you know, if you didn't know that before. So the scaled reptiles that are huge and often of which breathe fire, although admittedly the eastern dragons tend to be a little bit more benevolent. But I would say those two creatures. You also have anthropomorphic creatures, werewolves, and then in Native American lore there tends to be, you can shapeshift into animals. It depends on, obviously, on the specific groups there.
So, Glenn,
yes, Megan?
I think I know what the librarians do in Munich, and I think it's the same thing as what astronomers do in Munich. But,
which I have no idea about astronomers.
Just guessing here, but I have a question. Is there a diagnostic test that can reveal without actually going through the trauma of an apocalypse?
Yes, sign up for Social Work 290 this summer. No, that's a little bit in jest, but when we put people in there, we ask people to be there in real time. So when you speak, for instance, we have a survivor's journal, and so when you're journaling in the present tense, this is what happened. I didn't agree with the group's decision that we should kill so-and-so, or whatever, where you're put in those situations where it's a safe environment, but you're being forced to confront making a decision. At least it's kind of like a tabletop type of activity. It's a little hard to explain without actually showing you. Every week there's a video scenario. Well, I'll give you one example. And we don't always necessarily use this one, but you imagine you're in a small group of five or six people. You're in a, you know, you could be anywhere where you're located for this online simulation. You've been there for several days. You haven't gotten any more news from the government. You're barricaded in. You've assessed your environment. You've begun to get to know one another's strengths and weaknesses. And then in the middle of the night, you hear a pounding. Let me in! Let me in! Somebody's out there. They're after me. They're coming. You have to decide. Do you let them in? Do you send someone out to check it out? Or do you just keep quiet? And then when you make that decision, you have to report on the whys of that. So Megan, what would you do? Be very quiet. There's no right answer. Be very quiet.
Let me throw out a quick question to the group. You know, do you like being in control, or do you like being scared? I mean, all of us have been on rides at Cedar Point, whatever. I mean, to what degree is this feeling of being in a disaster, a catastrophe, facing the apocalypse, facing monsters, whatever, to what degree do we like to be in control, or what degree do we really like simply having control taken away from us in these kind of situations? Anybody?
I think different people would answer differently, because, I mean, you just look at medical interactions with the medical field. If I go in and the doctor tells me I have some serious disease, some people will say, okay, doctor, here's the keys to the car and the house, and you do what you got to do to fix me. And then there's another type of person who wants to interact very, you know, well, why do you want to do that? What's the evidence for this, that, or the other thing? So I think there's two very different types of interacting with a life or death situation, and we see it.
Well, is that your stuff, Malcolm, in terms of whether or not someone's a premillennial or whether or not they are a postmillennial and everything else?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. I think there's we all have two so far. I think you either want to be in control or you want to know someone is in control. The doctor case, you hand them the keys to the car and everything. You're saying, I'm trusting you to be in control. The one that's online, you know, doing WebMD and all this sort of stuff is the one who says, I want to be in control. I don't think anybody actually likes complete no control and not knowing that someone is in control. I think that, and unless I'm wrong, I think Cedar Point, you go to get scared knowing someone has built this thing and that you're going to come out safe on the other side. So therefore, I can let go and be scared knowing that, you know, it's not going to kill me. I think control is probably a very important thing for most human beings.
Okay. Any other comments from the panel about anything that's been said by each other? Or we can open it up to this fine group of people that we have out there.
I had one quick question. I heard earlier this week, or last week, that there was, is it an asteroid? An asteroid, yes.
Well,
okay. Passed by the Earth, they said it was about a third of a mile in width, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
If that, now it was some 700,000 miles away, so which I don't think is very far when you're looking at the whole solar system. But I was curious as to what kind of a environmental impact an object of that size had it hit the Earth. Can you?
Right, so if that object, about the size of a football field, if that had hit, it could have taken out a city.
So it could have taken out a city, okay.
You know, it would have had a crater roughly a few miles across. You know, it would have sent a lot of material into the atmosphere. If it hit water, it would cause a tsunami.
Well, on that bright note, why don't, if you have questions or comments, raise your hand. Stephanie's got the microphone, and we'd like to hear from you about any of these topics and about your feelings on zombies, monsters, and apocalypses as well. So raise your hand and right here.
I'll just add that NASA is tracking all those things of that size, so, you know, barring some surprises, we are following those objects, and we'll have at least some advance notice before they hit.
Great.
Mike, a question is actually along those lines. I was just wondering, when the next big asteroid hits the Earth, how big would it have to be to knock the Earth off its orbit and that would affect the environment around it?
You wouldn't have to knock it off its orbit to affect the environment. All you have to do is get some stuff into the upper atmosphere. And that, you know, and in fact, you only have to affect the upper atmosphere for, say, a growing season, and that would, you know, enable a major catastrophe. So that 65 million year ago impact was, that asteroid was pretty big. It was about 6 miles across.
Oh, the one that killed the dinosaurs?
The one that killed the dinosaurs. But most of the dinosaurs didn't get killed by the asteroid. It got killed by starvation, the weather that came afterwards. These animals had enormous caloric requirements, and basically that impact made room for small, efficient mammals to take over the Earth.
Here I thought that they had all had a mass suicide thing after understanding that the Earth was ending. But next question or comment, raise your hand about stuff that's going to hit us or not, as the case may be, or how we feel about it. Right here.
How realistic is it, in your opinion, the types of things that happen in shows like The Walking Dead or movies? Do you think people would actually behave that way in those proportions, or is it sort of more dramatized than you think it might actually be?
Oh, that's really a good question. Given some of the things that I've seen, you know, or heard about in human behavior, even happening nowadays with some of the, like ISIS and some of the brutality that's going on, I believe that see things very similar that actually are being depicted there. It's not necessarily a pretty sight. And I don't think it's that far off. Now, all of us would think, well, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't leave somebody behind. I wouldn't, you know, shoot somebody. I wouldn't, you know, do that. It's not until it's revealed that we will really know.
Other comments on that question? Okay. Raise your hands if you have a question or a comment over there.
This one's for Dr. McGee. I was interested in you talked about the latter part of your lecture on how you see a new era of progressive-minded evangelical youth. And I guess I just wanted to, I never saw things in that way. I guess I haven't seen that, and I just wanted to hear a little more of a discussion about why you think that is or some examples you've seen.
Several examples. First is anecdotally, under 35 age people that I talk to that are religious, who you could identify as evangelical, they tend to not identify themselves as that anymore. There are several Pew studies out showing a growing religious left in America. That tends to be in the United States from the more populist types of religions, Christian religions, rather than the staid sort of traditional mainline ones. So I think simultaneously polls and just general things that I've seen in terms of interviewing and talking to people, as soon as someone comes into my office, if they identify themselves as religious, I ask a whole bunch of questions. And I think there's a huge generational shift. Plus, the basic fundamental set of beliefs, Michael Kazin, who wrote a biography of William Jennings Bryan, pointed out very clearly that people can be on the left or the right politically sometimes for the very same reasons. They just simply interpret those reasons slightly differently. And since historically evangelicalism has tended to be on the left, I think it's fairly unsurprising that it would get back there eventually, though it has not been in your lifetime. Did that answer the question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let me ask a question about monster design, since you were nice enough to talk about it. Isn't it often the case that we're most scared of those things that are very much, it's like when suddenly a child, like Chucky or something else, where you get the thing that would look to be the weakest, the thing that would look to be the gentlest, suddenly turns and turns into a monster, that kind of, the whole changeling kind of notion. Are there some things that are, that we can draw that evoke certain types of feelings that are that's too far, you know, a baby with a machete or who knows what is a monster kind of thing?
There are. So I think, and that was what we also wanted to try to avoid when we were making these specific monsters, is I think when you take some of those things, like a monster that's super cute but with too many eyes or too many teeth, there's just something a little bit off there. It goes from being friendly to predatory. And I think that that's the line that, it's frankly the most interesting for me, but is that point at which people start to get kind of uncomfortable with that.
And do we know what are the most successful monsters from a visual point of view, that is the ones that people respond to the most as being monstrous?
I think it depends on the era. So I think specifically of the very first Alien film, that alien was really unsettling for people. Now we look at it and we're like, oh, that's neat, but it's not terribly scary. But it was very frightening. But I think it's the suspense too, especially, and this is true of hard sci-fi and horror, when you have that suspense and the buildup of fear, as opposed to just, here's a scary monster. It's, what is this creature going to do? Is it going to eat me? Is it going to cuddle me? I'm not sure. It's unclear. It's that feeling of uncertainty.
Okay. Other questions or comments that you have on any of these topics? Raise your hand. Right here.
Out of, like, all the monsters that exist, this is a question for any of you, why do you think zombies have become one of the most prevalent in today's society?
She said, we got tired of vampires. There seem to be, yeah, sometimes things are, they go through stages or they're cyclical. And I think there's something very frightening about something that is, you know, won't die. I mean, who mentioned Chucky? Chucky, yeah. Freaks me out, you know, like that. I hate that doll. Yeah, and clowns, you know. And but just the idea that something has human form but no longer, you know, is alive. I think too, although maybe this is getting a little on the darker side, these people still have human form, and it's okay to kill them in these scenarios, in these stories. Although The Walking Dead did have a thing during one of the seasons where, you know, they were trying to keep some of the zombies in a barn, maybe with the future hope of being able to treat whatever the underlying cause was. So that's kind of a scenario, you know, too. That's not really a complete answer. They're just, zombies are both terrifying and cool.
Other zombie answers on the panel?
I think maybe because there's enough humanity left in them that you look at them and you think, I could be that. When you look at an alien monster from, say, the Aliens movie again, you're never going to be that, but you could be a zombie. Well, you know, technically you couldn't, but there's still that sense of humanity and that fear of, wow, what if I lost control? Would I start eating people? I personally would not, but.
Well, isn't there also the problem that your grandmother could come back as a zombie, your dead child could come back as a zombie? I mean, in effect, your worst nightmare is being forced to confront and have to kill, you know, something that you've loved, I assume.
Exactly. But also, too, take note of, you know, if you've been following The Walking Dead or even some of these other movies and that, who are the real monsters now? They're really not the zombies. We have the monster within us. That's the one that scares me. After you survive the initial catastrophe and you manage to get through whatever that is, the thing we have to be concerned about is not zombies, but it's people.
Other questions? Let me, I've got one right there, and I think one over here, Stephanie. See, Stephanie, this is why I was running around with before, because it's an exercise program for older faculty like me to run around with.
I don't need that exercise.
Just a follow-up. One more idea was, there was that movie where Woody Harrelson survived the zombies by dressing up as a zombie, and he disguised himself, and he thinks he's really, really super clever, because he looks like a zombie, and then one of the survivors shoots him.
Yeah.
He realizes
this
is a mistake.
So,
yeah, the rules of the game change.
Very much so.
I have a question kind of geared towards Megan and Glenn, I guess. And I was thinking about the climate change, and you pointed out that, like, developing countries are causing the effects, the impacts of climate change. And then, like, Africa and South America, like, less developed people are gonna, you know, actually have to deal with those consequences. So, I don't know, towards kind of like what Glenn's class does, do you think it, like, how do you think if we tried to get together when, you know, droughts were happening in Africa, how do you think people in, like, Africa and Europe, how would they interact and try to deal with that disaster? And I don't know. Could you think of?
Yeah, that's really a good question. Maybe you can help me out with this as well. I think one of the interesting things in our class scenario, when you have a coronal mass ejection, and if it's large enough and a high enough class, and it hits the Earth direct enough, it will interfere with the electrical infrastructure, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The EMP pulse.
The EMP pulse, right. Ironically, the most developed countries in the world, if that were to be our catastrophe or our apocalypse, we might suffer much more than some of these other countries who are not so dependent upon electricity to run everything. Can you weigh in on how you would?
What I see is that the real hope, and this is where I think this millennial generation has a lot to offer, is that I think millennials think about the world in a more global way than their parents did. Their parents think about how things are affecting the United States, how these things affect me locally. But I think the millennials, because they're on the internet, because they might have friends in Israel or in South Africa, because it's so easy to communicate thousands of miles, in some sense the distance isn't an issue, and that they see the world as a more global place where, well, you know, you might know somebody in the Maldives where the islands are sinking under the water. You can contact somebody in Alaska and ask them, hey, I heard the glaciers are retreating. Is that true? What do you see? There's an easier way for individuals to sort of, have first degree connections to what's happening in other countries. So I see this as a hopeful thing. It's not like it's propagating or people are galvanizing really fast, maybe not fast enough, but I still have hope that millennials will, join hands with their friends, cross the Atlantic, cross the Pacific, and put our heads together, and we're going to save this planet.
There was a commercial actually during the Super Bowl with that, I think it's Woody Guthrie song, "This Land Is Your Land, This Land Is My Land." Every time I've heard that in my lifetime, that's all about us. United States, USA, go USA and that. But this time they took it global, if you saw the commercial. After the initial from sea to shining sea, then it went out and it showed other countries and the world. It really is, as Megan is saying, it really is our world. And we really do, we need all of us. We need one another.
You want to bring in? I saw a question over here.
I had a question that's kind of twofold. My first question for any one of you, what do you think it is that's behind the human fascination with mythology and these catastrophic kind of stories, first of all? And then the second part of the question is, I grew up being taught about apocalyptic literature being out of the historic context that it was written in, to be taken very literally. And I was very scared as a child in that sense, only to grow up to find that there's lots of catastrophes in the world that might not be necessarily mythological, but actual catastrophes that are human-induced. So what would you say to a skeptic about the value of looking into catastrophe or stories about zombies? What value does that bring to mankind?
Let me start on the right and move to the left. So does anybody want to weigh in?
I'd like to weigh in on the mythology thing for a second, and then because I've actually just been thinking about this and I've just spouted it off to a couple of classes. First off, more truth can often be conveyed in fiction than in any set of statistical reports. We can see all the scientific data about an asteroid hitting, but if someone writes a story about it where people are in it, they feel it. Right off the top, without thinking, three books that changed America: Uncle Tom's Cabin. Lincoln meeting her says, "Oh, you're the little lady that started this war." Bellamy's Looking Backward, that I talked about, that really transformed the Gilded Age into the Progressive Era. Literally within 6 months, there are Bellamy clubs around the country. And it, you know, on a lesser scale, The Jungle, changing the way we deal with food. All of them fiction, all of them mythological, if you would. All of them conveyed a truth in a way that people understood and changed the course of history. One of the things that we have to understand is the sciences and the humanities must have each other, because one gets the data and the other can tell the story, and they need each other in that regard. So
my primary mythological interest has evolved over time, but it's Celtic mythology, early Irish mythology. And I think there's a lot to be learned from how the peoples of that time viewed themselves and the challenges that they went through as their culture was evolving. On a smaller scale, it's kind of related to what you're saying with the later fiction. But that's a really good question. And I'm not sure. Yeah, I'll pass it on down.
Anybody want to weigh in?
I forgot the question.
Well, the power of myth, you know, I think the way that Malcolm has put it, you know, what metaphor allows us to do is transform one thing into something else. So the degree to which we are able to have explanatory power through being able to tell a story about one thing or another. You know, nothing against any of you of a certain age in the room, but it isn't until you have teenagers that you understand what the story about the changeling is all about. That is, it's somehow something that was raised, you say, would someone please bring back my son or daughter, the real one, and take this you know, imitation copy away. But there are a number of myths, I think, that really are right at the heart of relationship to nature, relationship to life, death, all the great tropes that we have. And I think it's that ability to understand that, what I asked earlier, that to what degree are we in control? To what degree are we not in control? What kind of advice can we get from the stories that tell us how to act in Glenn's zombie apocalypse? Other comments on that? Oh, back here we have a...
I'll just add my little spin, and that is that one of the things I find most impressive about human beings is that, yeah, they've had stories for centuries, but now, with the tools of science, we have the possibility of telling our own story and telling stories that have legitimacy over many, many centuries, actually millions of years from now. Can you imagine, like, what an ant might do if an ant could, say, project, you know, 200 years into the future, beyond many generations? But science allows us to do that, to think about not only what's going to happen 10 years from now, 20 years from now, but millions of years from now, billions of years from now, and think about, I don't know, even, you know, the longevity of matter. I think that's incredible. So there are myths, and then there are this very, very potent tool of science, of understanding our universe, and what an incredible story that is turning out to be, and it's a relatively recent thing we've been doing.
Back here.
So I just wanted to, I have a very heavy interest as well in monsters. It's what I did my master's thesis on. And so I just wanted to chime in really quick about the monsters. And one of the things that I noticed when I was working on my thesis and even my artwork, a lot of my artwork deals with monsters and the concepts of monsters. And at the very core of it, a lot of times, it's really about breaking of the rules or going against the norm, those sort of things. And when you look at some of the monsters that, like, people over time say that really scare them or that really, you know, bring in that fear factor. including like aliens was one of them that people talked about, you start to see where rules, even how the thing looks, break down. Eyes are not in the same place where you would think eyes would be. And so I think, you know, even with like a zombie or something like that, you get into ideas of, you know, this thing is walking, but it's not alive. It doesn't have personality. It doesn't have, you know, feelings or emotions. So it's really what I found to be most interesting was this common thread that in monsters from all over the place, they usually represented the breaking or going against what we expect or what we think should be happening.
Comments on that, folks?
Well, and the battling of monsters can also be very empowering. We see this a lot in different mythologies as well. You have the hero battling this supreme creature and coming to find a special power within him or herself. So I think it's also about empowerment, not necessarily for the monster or for the zombie, but for the person involved in interacting with the monster.
Let me raise a monster for the panel and also for all of you as the audience, and that is that we're now totally caught up in pandemic as catastrophe. You know, measles is now back in the news. I'm reading a novel right now called I Am Pilgrim that's all about a terrorist attack using smallpox. Two of the Michigan notable books this year, one of them happens to be Station 11, which was shortlisted for the National Book Award, and that's about a pandemic called the Georgia flu that hits North America and the rest of, as far as people can tell, the Northern Hemisphere, decimating 90% of the population. So isn't it that we live in such a medical informed world now that so many of our catastrophes are now medical? I mean, to the degree that you were raising, I think, Glenn, that this asteroid hits, and lo and behold, what happens is that people are turned into zombies, which is a medical kind of thing, that they are transformed by, could be a germ, could be something else. I mean, to what degree has kind of the medical world given us either new catastrophes or kind of transformed the way we look at catastrophe, or monsters for that matter? Anybody want to weigh in?
No? I think germs have become, in a sense, the sort of demons of the modern world, and indeed you find people develop an almost phobia because this is something that's simultaneously real but can't be seen, and therefore it's an unseen reality. You can't see a germ, so you know there's the constant sanitation, everything, and doing all that, which actually may be doing more damage than good. I don't know. I'd be different reports on whether you should be using all this sanitizer or not, but yeah, someone.
I would add, there's the chance of randomly being hit, and this is, a cancer, right? Cancer is terrifying in part because most instances of cancer is just a product of some random course of events. Nothing you did, no behavior you had, wasn't caused by you. It was just, boom, there you are, you have cancer, now you've got to deal with it. And I think that's also the scary part of disease, is where, there's no, it's not a morality play where the bad people get killed and the good people survive, which is what most Hollywood disaster movies are, but just random acts of decimation, right?
Other questions or comments over here?
Yeah, John, you took a little bit of my question, so I'm reformulating. mainly for Dr. McGee, as everybody is talking tonight, a lot of our apocalyptic visions right now, there are global disasters, cosmic rays, that actually lead into what Glenn is doing. But throughout time, looking at different apocalyptic scenarios, what Valita was talking about, have we been making our own monsters all a long time to meet those apocalyptic thoughts and ideas?
Very good question. So I can't help but think of around the era that the Dracula book came out and Frankenstein, that people were starting to come into an understanding of health issues, and this ties into what we were discussing before, too. And that was kind of a turning point for the fiction of the monster. So we can start creating our own monsters. At that point, Frankenstein is created. I'm kind of not really touching on your question, but...
Well, I think it's, and then Dr. McGee, our people have been throughout time using those ideas of creating our own monsters to fuel the apocalyptic visions.
I was sitting here buying time because I'm trying to decide whether they created the monsters to further a belief or whether the belief caused them to create the monster. I think in its original form, apocalyptic literature was not intended to be taken literally. It was really coded literature designed for people to get messages. And if you had the inside insight, you knew what the dragon was, you knew what the beast was, you knew what the number was, you knew what this was. And therefore, it's like, okay, we don't want everybody to know what we're telling you, so we're saying this in coded language, and we're telling this story that you will be able to figure out if you know. But subsequently, later on, a different kind of literalist approach to certain apocalyptic literature caused them to say, oh, this is, you know, it's certainly colorful language, and I think that it created a different approach. You have mythological literature in which there are monsters that are actual monsters and you do it, and then you have apocalyptic literature where monsters are symbols, and I think sometimes people merge those together, and your question actually is just leaving me with a whole bunch of spinning extra questions.
I'm sorry about that.
But in a way, is the question, is it, you know, when Frankenstein was created as an image, the notion was that man could create his own monsters that could in effect kill man, okay? Much of what we've talked about on this panel tonight, whether it be climate change or even superbugs and some of the other stuff, we get what we deserve, right? In that way, it matches a religious apocalyptic vision that somehow matches a moral universe where don't touch that, because if you touch that, you know what's going to happen. You know, kind of Pandora's box, all the other mythological stuff. I mean, to a degree, is that what you're raising, that so much of what we have now is, in effect, man-made disasters? We feel very good about an asteroid hitting the Earth because we didn't cause it. Whereas climate change, that we can do something about, but, you know, maybe we deserve it because we're the ones that are driving the cars, you know, or whatever. I think that's the balance, I think, that you're laying out. Did I get that right? No. Other comments over here? Another question?
I actually have a completely different question, but kind of in respect to you mentioning the jungle, I was wondering if you could speak to the global food crisis and how you think people will react when we inevitably run out of food, whether it's down the line or...
You mentioned
the jungle. Could you repeat your question?
Yeah, I was just wondering if any of you could speak to this, but how you think people will react when eventually humanity runs out of food, like if there were some type of crisis, like I guess the moral aspect of it, of how you think people will, like what you think they'll like hoard food or if it'll become like a community response.
Okay, I did mention the jungle, which has nothing.
Yeah, that just made me think of the question.
But that actually prompts me to think of something that's more present, which is the global food distribution problem, in which way more food is produced. There's enough food produced that we should not have hunger or starvation in the world. I think there's a huge moral issue tied to food distribution that has a current need to be solved that always seems to take precedence in my mind over the ultimate global food shortage. But then I'm maybe a much shorter term thinker. I only think in centuries, not...
When I think with those basic fundamental things like food and water, you have to have food. You have to have water. And I think when those two things become in jeopardy, the veneer of civilization get pretty thin. And just think about it in terms of maybe not yourself, but your children. If your children are starving and they're near death, what are you going to do? You are going to get food. And if someone down the road or down in Ann Arbor, let's say, has food, guess what? We're going to Ann Arbor and we're not coming back without the food to fill our children so that they will continue to survive. These are very, very, you know, powerful human needs and realities.
Okay, a last question right here, perhaps.
I was just kind of taking it back to the us creating our own monsters, and just, I'm curious. One, does humanity have a need for monsters? Do we, like, I tell my kids, you know, no, monsters don't exist so that they can sleep through the night. But do we need these villains, you know, real and imagined, to kind of keep pressing us forward, to keep being innovative, I don't know. Maybe you guys have some other reasons. And secondly, just an observation that I think throughout history our monsters have been mysteriously linked to the centuries we were in or the decades we were in. Like, you look at the movies that came out during the Cold War, and the monsters are pretty much the Soviet Union. You know, I mean, it's got fangs and tentacles, but it's pretty much just the Soviet Union dressed up. And in the 80s, you know, it started to, you know, become other things. And you mentioned all the medicinal things now. And to me, in the last 10 years, YouTube didn't exist 10 years ago. Like, everything's gone viral. And so I think our new monster is how we're all connected, and everything can go viral. And it's this, you know, we're celebrating it, but we're also afraid of it. So anyway, that was just an observation. But my question more is, do we need these monsters?
Wow.
Do we need deadlines? Do we need the fact that we're mortal to actually accomplish things? Do we? I think you know the answer.
Any other takes on whether or not we need monsters?
I think monsters can be helpful and profitable.
I really like monsters, so I'm going to go with yes.
Glenn, weigh in on monsters.
I think that's a great last question. I'm looking forward to seeing your article on it. It's a great question.
You know, the notion of needing something outside of ourselves, either on the one side to scare us or on the other side to give us solace, you know, it's John Cage once said, sometimes in the theater of life, the best people get the worst seats. And, you know, I think that it's interesting that in many of our notions of monsters or whatever, often it is the people that deserve, I mean, you know, there are people who get cheered in various monster films when that is the person who happens to get killed by, you know, whoever the villain happens to be. So I think that this is really about how we confront a moral, or try to impose maybe perhaps a moral universe on top of something that very well may look much more like, you know, entropy or something else. You know, one thing about the question of how the world will end, I think if I remember my term correctly, the term is heat death of the universe, that when all of the particles move apart from each other, where finally they can't interact or whatever, I mean, you know, that's how we're all going to die in the cold. We're not necessarily going to die in a large bang. And so it just depends on what you're trying to come to grips with. I think sometimes monsters help a lot. You know, they give us we can define why something happens. But on the other side, solace helps a lot, too. There's somebody out there tracking down those monsters. Thank God for the Avengers and the Fantastic Four, after
and
all,
NASA.
Right? And NASA. And NASA. With that, we can't thank you enough for coming. Please do come back on March 30th. Please do give this wonderful faculty panel another round of applause if you will.